I want to share with you a talk that's really important. I've been working on this topic for a while because Christianity is under attack. And every day I keep reading, I see posts and I see attacks and I see, you know, people writing articles in magazines and in newspapers constantly attacking Christianity and belittling our faith and attacking us for believing that there's a creator and attacking us for, you know, calling us people that are middle, that are stuck in the Middle Ages, that we have never progressed, that how could we believe, you know, that there's a God who created when evolution has shown us that we don't need a God, and how could we even say that the nature points to God? And it's a constant attack, and we need to have a good answer, and we have excellent answers. Actually, when you see the evidence, you understand why everybody is so defensive, because they don't have a leg to stand on. The reason why our society is so out there in your face is because they know they have what they're representing can't stand up to scrutiny. And it's becoming a bigger and bigger deal, a bigger and bigger problem. More and more scientists are realizing that there's something wrong with our picture, the way that we have seen nature and understood it. So I'm calling this talk Intelligent Design, the Fingerprints of God. And here's let me show you where I'm going with this. If we look at a painting like that, anybody know who the painter is? It's a very famous painting. It's not Van Gogh. In that little corner, there's a signature. Let me blow it up for you. It's Monet. Okay? You look at this painting. That's Picasso, right? Cubism. You see all the things moved to where they're not supposed to be? That's Picasso. Okay? You look at something like this. Who? Salvador Dali. Excellent. That's the signature that's on there. Salvador Dali. And last one. If you see this one, who do you? Wow. Good job. Degas. I didn't think anybody would get that one, but yep. It's a very famous painting of Degas. The point I'm telling you is, the reason I'm showing you this is because when you look at these paintings, somebody painted them. Somebody autographed them. And interestingly, when I was doing this studying and preparing this, I started looking at works of art to see for signatures. And a lot of major classic works of art have no signature on them. Like the painter didn't put their name on it. Like the first one I went for was Mona Lisa. Mona Lisa doesn't have Da Vinci's name on it. We know he painted it, but he didn't sign it. At least not in the front. And so a lot of these paintings, I thought that was interesting. But you can learn the style of a painter and kind of figure it out without knowing who, without seeing the signature, you start to learn. If you're an art connoisseur, you start to learn who the painter is just by looking at the way they use the color, the texture, etc., and their style. And so when the Psalm 19 says that the heavens declare the glory of God and the firmament shows his handiwork, what I see there is that when you look at the natural world, it has a signature too. It's a work of art done by a God who created it and put a signature on it. And sometimes the signature is not patently obvious, but sometimes it is. You start to learn. You look at the created universe and there's a fingerprint there. And that fingerprint is God. It's everywhere you look. The AP just came out with a story today that they found probably the largest supernova ever. They're not even sure if it's a supernova. It's so large. And they're all excited, and they're starting to do research. And every time they find these things, it just blows you away at the incredible immensity of the universe, which we're going to come back to in a little bit. When you look let me show you a video clip where even atheists admit this. Okay, listen to this quote from Richard Dawkins, directly from him. Let's put sound on. Sound on for audio. Good.
And I suppose it's possible that you might find evidence for that if you look at the details of biochemistry, molecular biology, you might find a signature of some sort of designer.
Did you catch that? He says, if you look at the details of biochemistry and molecular biology, you might find the signature of some sort of designer. So even atheists say, you know what? You can't look under a microscope and not notice that there's got to be some kind of designer there. Obviously, if you watch that Expelled documentary, the follow-up question is, well, who is it? And he says, well, nobody knows. Well, who is it? Well, it could be an alien. And that's where he goes with that. Maybe aliens, intelligent life from other planets, seeded life here on this planet. Because anybody but God in his mind, but I don't care about his mind. I care about what he just said. He said that if you look at the details of biochemistry and molecular biology, you're going to find the signature of a designer there. It's undeniable. I can show you quotes from biologists, biomolecular geneticists, all these guys. And what are they telling you? Candidly, off camera, they'll tell you that nobody in their field believes that it happened by chance without an unguided process. But they never admit that. Why? Because you don't get grants. You don't get the research money. You don't get tenure in a university professorship if you admit that. But everybody knows. In genetics, everybody knows that there's a signature of a designer. So what he just told you is that when you look at DNA and you look at the complexity of the biochemical composition of people, what you see is a signature. It's a fingerprint. It's God telling you, hey, I did this. And I want to show you how. I want to show you what Richard Dawkins means. I want to show you how it works. We're going to do a little bit of science tonight. Not a lot, and I'm going to make it really simple. You don't have to be a scientist to understand it, but you need to know these basics. You need to catch this because this is really, really important that we understand that science supports the view that in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Science supports the view that man is created in the image of God, fearfully and wonderfully made. Science supports the view that we did not come about by random, unguided processes, but that we came about as the special design of the greatest designer of the universe, the designer of the universe itself, the God of the Bible. So evolutionary biology will tell you this, and you'll read this in some of the textbooks. Evolutionary biology is built on the premise that there is no design in nature, only the appearance of design. It's so obvious that there's design in nature that these guys will tell you, look, you know, it really looks design. It looks design, but it's only the appearance. It's misleading. It's not really design. It's only the appearance of design. So he himself told you in a book called The Blind Watchmaker, he says, biology is a study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. They give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. Well, guess what? They have a purpose and they have been designed, and we're going to show you that. It's not just the appearance. So you compare the two perspectives on design, okay? The Bible says that we are fearfully, he says, in the book of Job, it says, you, in the book of Psalms, it says, you created my innermost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. That's Psalm 139. Then you look at Richard Dawkins, who tells you that what we have is the appearance of design, and you have a choice to make. Who's right? Is the Bible right or is Richard Dawkins right? Come on, the Bible was written 4,000 or 5,000 years ago by men that were, you know, that were dumb. They had no education. They didn't have Oxford degrees. And Richard Dawkins is a guy with an Oxford degree, and he's a biologist and a scientist. So who are you going to believe? Well, let's look at the evidence and let's see who's got it right. You look at Francisco Ayala, past president of the American Association of Advancements in Science, and he's really funny. He says this. He says, the functional design of organisms and their features would therefore seem to argue for the existence of a designer, but he doesn't let that last long. He follows that up by saying that Darwin's greatest accomplishment is to show that the directive organization of living beings can be explained as a result of natural process, natural selection, without any need to resort to a creator or other external agent. What is he saying? Yeah, it looks designed, but Darwin settled that. It looks designed, but Darwin showed us that it's not. He gave us the mechanism. Natural selection, working on random mutations, can account for everything. You can go from the simplest to the most complex organisms. All you need is a lot of time and a lot of chance and a lot of mutations. And so everything is possible. That's Darwin's answer. And so he says we don't need to resort to a God or a creator to answer design. But I'm going to use tonight abductive reasoning. And I've mentioned this to you before because this is what scientists use. historical scientists. When you're not doing science in the laboratory, when you're doing science about things that cannot be repeated and cannot be observed, you then have to resort to this type of reasoning. It's called abductive reasoning. Everybody does it. You know, in forensics, that's the only thing you do. Forensics is science. But a forensic person comes to a crime scene and they didn't see the crime happen. They weren't there and they can't duplicate it. They can't make the crime happen again. What they have to do is look at what the evidence is there and figure out what happened. What's the best possible explanation? And that's what abductive reason is. It's the inference of the best possible explanation. There may be more than one cause that explains the effect in question. The explanations that provides the most adequate causal explanation is the one we're looking for. You compare, what are the possible answers? Which is the best one? Which best accounts for what we see? If you look at, there's a great book called Cold Case Christianity, and he wrote a second book, I forgot the name of it now, J. Warner Wallace, and he used to be a detective for Los Angeles Police Department, and now he wrote a book on, and he used to be an atheist, and now he wrote a book where he shows that, you know, if you do detective work on the Bible and what it says and the stories there, what you find is that they're true. The evidence is there to support that what is being said is true. The case for Christ is true. The case for the resurrection is true. And he goes about it in a different way because he goes about it how he would have done any investigation of a crime scene, which is pretty interesting. That's inference to the best explanation. So we're going to use proteins as our example. And a protein is very simply defined as a functional linear chains of amino acids. It's a series, the way you build the protein, and our bodies need proteins for everything. Proteins are part of everything, all our organs, everything is made of proteins. They're the building blocks. And amino acids are what make a protein, okay? So let me briefly show you that, what that looks like. Proteins have something called sequence specificity. Big scientific words, I'll tell you what it is, it doesn't mean a lot. The function of the whole depends on the arrangement of the parts. It's the same thing. We have, in our language, we have sequence specificity. What does that mean? That if you throw a bunch of letters together, it doesn't mean anything. For something to have meaning, the letters have to be in a certain order, the punctuation has to be in a certain place, and you have words, and you have sentences, and then you have paragraphs, and you have books, and the only way it has meaning is if everything is not only complex, but specified. Everything is in its right place. And that's what we're talking about. When a protein is like, think of a protein as a page on a novel or a page in a book. Every letter has to be in the right place or else you're not going to convey the meaning that you were supposed to convey. So the fundamental question is, what determines the function of protein? The sequence does. The way these amino acids are put together determines what that protein is going to do. Different proteins do different things based on the way the exact order of the amino acids, and not only that, it has to be folded, and there are all these three-dimensional parts that have to be folded just right for it to work. I'll show you a little bit more about that in a minute. Where does the order come from? We know that there is another molecule in the cell called DNA that encodes the instructions. Where did the information, instructions found in DNA come from? It all comes down to information. It all comes down to information. The protein is built based on instructions. The cell has instructions on how to build the DNA. Those instructions are in the DNA itself. The cell has instructions how to build proteins, and those instructions are in the DNA itself. It's pretty amazing. Let me show you how that works. First of all, we're talking about information, and information is the key. Okay, the fastest growing field of science right now is communication, is information science. It's the fastest growing field of science right now. It's the field of science related to genetics that works on the code, the DNA code, cracking the code, understanding what it means, and being able to translate it to the point where we know what every gene does, and when we can look at somebody's chromosomes, we can see exactly, you know, everything we want to know. The idea is in the future, we'll be able not only to map your DNA, you can do that now, but to know what everything does specifically. To be able to read the book. That's the fastest growing field of science, being able to read the book. Because if you're able to read the book, you're able to duplicate the instructions. And I'm going to show you geneticists that are already doing computer models based on the code from DNA, and in the computer model, it does exactly what the DNA does, which is mind-boggling. what science is doing now, and it's information science. It's the fastest growing field of science. Watch this.
This animation demonstrates how the digital information encoded within DNA is used to direct protein synthesis. This is a DNA double helix containing the digital code which directs the cell in all aspects of operation. And here we see a protein complex called an RNA polymerase traveling down the DNA strand. As it moves down the strand, it carefully unwinds the DNA, preparing it for transcription. Inside the polymerase, we see a single-stranded copy of the original instructions being assembled as individual bases are positioned and added to the growing strand. A stop code marks the end of the protein specification, at which point this copy, known as a messenger RNA transcript, exits the polymerase and heads towards a two-part chemical manufacturing machine called the ribosome. While the messenger RNA moves towards the ribosome, transfer RNA molecules attach to specific amino acids in preparation for assembly. As the messenger RNA transcript passes through the ribosome, the process of translation begins. Using the instructions encoded on the messenger RNA as a template, the transfer RNA molecules align specific sequences of bases to corresponding amino acids, creating a protein chain. As this chain exits the ribosome, it is met by chaperones which prevent premature folding, while escorting the protein to a barrel-shaped machine called a chaperonin. This machine helps fold the protein into the precise shape required to perform its function. Although it is unclear how the chaperonin achieves this, we do know that accurate folding is essential in order for the protein to accomplish its intended function. Once the protein is complete, it is released into the cytoplasm to do its job.
As you can see, protein synthesis is an amazing process which occurs constantly in our bodies. Now, get this. Ribosomes are made from RNA and proteins, so the ribosomes are made of the very proteins they manufacture. In fact, it takes over 150 existing proteins to manufacture just one protein. So in essence, it takes a protein to make a protein. It's this chicken and egg scenario that continues to baffle scientists.
How do you explain the manufacturing of protein if you need proteins to manufacture the proteins? It's a chicken and an egg dilemma. What you just saw was how a protein is manufactured. Your body makes all of these proteins consistently, constantly. Your cells are working day and night, 24/7. Your cells are factories that are manufacturing and manufacturing and manufacturing, and they have a lifespan, and when the cell is about to die, it transfers all of its information to a new cell, and you get another cell with, and it keeps on manufacturing. It's amazing, the information that's being transferred, and we're going to see a little bit more about it in a minute. Okay. So what we have is complexity versus specified complexity. What type of information are we talking about in DNA? I can pick up letters from a Scrabble bag and get something very improbable, but does it convey any meaning or functional information? No. Okay, so complexity is not enough to say that the information is complex, because complexity is the same as saying improbable. Okay, you can have information. The information in DNA is not just complex. This is complex. It doesn't mean anything, but it's complex. What are the odds of getting that same row of letters if you did it again on your typewriter? Not very likely on your keyboard. So the idea becomes complex is not enough. DNA is not just complex, it's specified complexity, which means that the message has function to it. It's something more like this. Where you have meaning, you have spaces, you have punctuation, you have capitalization, you have words that have meaning. Turn off the lights and close the door. If you see this message, you don't believe it was randomly generated. Somebody wrote this, somebody thought of this, and somebody communicated this information. So when you think about this, what function does it perform? It tells the cell how to arrange the amino acids to build the protein. Now, Francis Crick, which is one of the people who discovered DNA, the helix formation of DNA, a tremendous scientist, who, by the way, who doesn't believe in God or anything like that, or didn't believe in God. But here's what he said. He says, by information, I mean the specification of the amino acid sequence in the protein. Information means here the precise determination of sequence, either of the base in the nucleic acid or of the amino residues in the protein. All he's saying there is, look, when I mean information, I'm talking about instructions, detailed instructions of where to put each amino acid and how to fold the chain. If that doesn't happen, you have nothing, okay? So the information in biology is information that performs an important function. If we are trying to explain the origin of life, we have to be clear as to what we're trying to explain. What's the fundamental mystery of life? The origin of information. Specified functional information. That's the question to ask any naturalist biologist. That's the question to ask any geneticist that doesn't believe that there's a God. Any scientist who's in the biological and molecular chemical fields, you can ask them this question. All I want to know is, where did the information come from? Where did the information come from? Without information, you have no life. The foundation of life is information. Where did it come from? And we're going to look at, there's three possible answers that they're going to give, and none of them work. Okay, so has the appearance of design been explained away by the undirected process? Okay, so the key to the whole Darwinian model is that it's only an appearance of design. If there is a designer, then Darwinism falls apart, because then you have the intelligence behind it. So appearance of design equals undirected processes. So let's look and see if this can happen by undirected processes of random mutations and variation. Okay, can the strategy work when we're talking about the origin of life? In particular, the origin of information you need to get life going. So here we need math to do this, okay? So here's the first explanation. Where did you get the information? Oh, it just came about by chance. And a lot of, you don't need a source for the information. It just happened by chance. If you take Scrabble pieces and you throw them, one time you're going to throw them and you're going to get a sentence. You may have to throw them a gazillion times, but you will get a sentence one day. And that's just by chance, random chance. Okay? So let's see if this works. Here's one of the proponents of this idea, Leninger. We come now to the critical moment in evolution which the first semblance of life appeared. How did it appear? Through the chance association of a number of abiotically formed macromolecular components. That's a very easy way to say it. Very fancy way to say it, but what he's talking about, that everything you just saw in that video happened by chance. All of these components, the ribosome and the every part, the DNA, the RNA, everything happened by chance. All of those, the whole factory built was built by chance. That's what he's saying, okay? So, amino acids arrange themselves into proteins by chance alone. So, we have to explore this. Can it happen by chance, okay? When we're talking about chance, we're talking about probabilities. It's math. When you talk the word chance, you're talking about math, probability. So it's a problem of combinatorials, that, you know, the problem is in the combinations. Let me show you what I mean by this, okay? If you have, what are the odds of getting a combination of four numbers? If you have a bike lock or something with four digits, four dials with 10 numbers, 0 through 9 is 10 digits. That's 10 to the fourth power. That means you have 10,000 possible combinations. Amazingly, in a four number lock, you have 10,000 possible combinations. That's a lot of combinations. Four places, 10 digits each. Let's see if it gets a little, how it gets when it's a little more complicated. Let's go 10 dials. 10 dials with 10 digits, now you have 10 trillion combinations. 10 trillion combinations. Okay, that's unheard of. Nobody can solve that by chance. To get all the right digits at the right time, impossible, okay? So that's kind of like where we're going. The more numbers you, the more spaces you have, called sites, the more complicated it is that they will all line up with the right number, okay? So amino acids, how does this work? They're the building blocks from which proteins can be constructed. When you have a typical amino acid sequence, here are some of the typical amino acids, and their sequences. That's just the chemical way of describing them. But here's how you describe them for our argument's sake, okay? Let's say we're going to make a protein that has 10 amino acids, which is a tiny protein, okay? 10 amino acids. The problem is that there's 20 to choose from. 10 sites and 20 amino acids to choose from. So when you're going to fill in the spot on the chain for A, you have 20 different to choose from. Then you're going to, when you're going to fill in the spot for the second amino acid, you have 20 more to choose from. When you're going to do C, you have 20 more, and D, 20 more to choose from. So you have 10 sites with 20 amino acids. That's the same as over 10 trillion possibilities. So what are the odds of getting 1 in 10 trillion? That's bad. Those odds are not good, okay? But here's another problem. Most proteins are not 10 amino acids. Most proteins are not. Most proteins are 100 to 150 amino acid sites. There's a chain of 100 to 150 amino acids. And for every one of those, there's 20 options. What does that do to the math? It goes crazy. The average length, the most common are 1 to 150. The average length is 300 to 400 amino acid sites. Now, 300 amino acids lined up, and for every one of those, you have the combination of 20 possible amino acids. What's that going to do to your chance? Okay? So somebody will say, well, okay, and here's Hector Avalos, the guy I debated a couple of years ago. He was confronted with this by somebody, and here's what he said. He said, well, here's the deal. Yeah, there's all these combinations, but no matter what combination you get, you're going to get some function. Wrong. In other words, no matter how you line them up, it'll come up with something functional. No, that's not the way it works. It just shows that he's very ignorant about this topic. Nobody will tell you that. The actual chance of getting one of these is horrific, but we're going to get there in a minute. Odds of getting combination chance. Okay, so let's go to 150 sites, which is an average size or a common size. 20 sites, that now is 10 to the 195th power. That's a 10 with 195 zeros after it. One in that. You're not talking trillion or quintillion. You're talking about numbers that don't have names anymore. They're just numbers. I'm going to talk to you about infinite in a minute because that's kind of interesting. I ran into that when I was preparing this. Okay? So, there are only 10 to the 80th elementary particles in the whole universe. You know how big the universe is, right? It's huge. We don't know how big it is. It's so huge. If you counted all the atoms, protons, electrons, and neutrons in the entire universe, the number would be 10 to the 80th, more or less. So the odds that we just looked at, 10 to 195, is more than twice the number of elementary particles in the whole universe. That's how big that number is. It's hard to even imagine these numbers. That's why we use scientific notation. How likely is it that we find a functional protein just arising by chance in a prebiotic puddle of amino acids? You first have to account, where did the amino acids come to begin with? But anyway, we won't go there. That's another question. So how rare are functional sequences? Let's say, okay, any sequence that come up, it's probably going to be functional. It doesn't matter which protein you put where, you're going to come up with something functional. No, not quite. When you do the math, for every possible sequence that you can do, how many are functional? Just one? In 10 to the 74th. That means getting a functional sequence is rare. Super rare. 10 with 74 zeros. One, you have to have 10 with 74 zero tries to get one that works. One functional sequence. So chance is not a good answer. Okay? When you add the fact that linkage between each amino acid, by the way, there's a linkage. And there's... It's a 50-50 chance. You're either going to get a right hand or you're going to get a left hand in every linkage. So that adds to it. When you put it all together, by the way, only the left-handed work. In nature, in the body almost always produces left-handed amino acids. The connectors, the building for proteins, left-handed polymers, and in the laboratory, we get the 50-50 mix. We get right and left-handed, but the body doesn't waste a lot of time on right-handed ones. So when you do the math, the chances of getting one protein of 150 sites is 1 in 10 to the 164th. Practically impossible. Practically impossible. So chance is not a good answer. When you figure out how many elementary particles are in the entire universe, 10 to the 164th is not, it's not even possible. It's a number, yeah, but it's not a possible number to get. So all of this time we've been talking about just one protein. But how many proteins does it take to build a cell? We're not talking about a cell, we're talking about a protein. How many proteins does it take to build a cell? Nobody really knows exactly, but we figure about 250 to 400 proteins. So one cell is built of 250 to 400 proteins. Every one of those proteins is impossible to get by chance. And then to get the right proteins to build the cell? Really? Chance? Not a good hypothesis. And then I want to watch this. Let's get some sound.
And what's fascinating to me, not only do proteins create proteins, but we have proteins that are actually creating the DNA molecule. That's our blueprint. And yet on the DNA molecule, there are sequences of part of the DNA that are coded for those proteins. So the manufacturing plant needs the blueprint, and the blueprint, the DNA, needs the manufacturing plant in order to actually create the DNA. So what came first, the proteins that made the DNA or the DNA that made the proteins?
These are the kind of questions that point to him. That's what created, that's who did it and how he did it, okay? Explanation two, okay, natural selection. Okay, this is not by chance necessarily, but by chance and necessity. In other words, chance and necessity. Natural selection, picking those mutations and variations that work, etc., can account for it. But the problem is you have natural selection acting prior to life. Who's selecting what if there's no life? Okay? The problem is natural selection depends on reproduction. The whole process presupposes organisms that can copy themselves. But those are the organisms you're trying to explain how they got built. So you can't use them to explain how they got built, because they're the ones you're trying to explain to begin with. The copying depends on information in DNA and the functional proteins. But what are we trying to explain the origin of? The functional proteins and the information that made those organisms. So before you have anything that's self-replicating, you have to have the DNA, the blueprints, and the factory. So you can't say that the self-replicating organisms are the origin. No, they're not. They're the product of the blueprints and the factory.
Sound? When a gene is active, the coding sequence is copied in a process called transcription, producing a messenger RNA or mRNA copy of the gene's information. mRNA is produced by a protein that's over 3,000 amino acids long as it reads the genetic code. Wait a minute. How can messenger RNA require a protein that reads the genetic code, but yet the protein needs the messenger RNA to be produced? Could these have both come into existence at the exact same time with the meaningful information needed for both to operate properly? As you can see, much is still a mystery when it comes to the origin of this complex organic language.
Now, did you catch something? The one protein that makes the RNA, an RNA polymerase, is that how you say it? Polymerase, okay? That one protein is made up of 3,000 amino acids. Not 150, not 10, not 3,000 amino acids, okay? So I tried to do the math on that one. The odds of getting the protein that makes messenger RNA by chance, 3,000 sites at 20 possibilities, is 20 to the 3,000th power, which, by the way, to simplify it to that, was a nightmare, okay? Because I used online calculators, and there's a problem. When you enter into an online calculator any number greater than an exponent of 309, the answer is infinity. The calculator says the infinity. I'm serious. Try it at home. Go online and get the calculator. And when you enter into the scientific calculator, the base, 20, the exponent, 3,000, and you hit calculate, it says the answer, infinity. And so I started to look, well, what's the cutoff point? 319. If you go 10 to the 319th power, it's going to 309th power, it's going to give you an answer. When you do 10 to the 310th, infinity. So at 300, the calculator says that number is infinite. We can't figure it out. But in order to make this that one protein, it's not 300, it's 3,903, factors of 10. Think about that. What are the odds of just that one protein being made by chance? It's not possible. It's impossible for it to be done. So prebiotic natural selection is really begging the question. It doesn't work. You can't get information unless you already have information. And prebiotic natural selection is not a good hypothesis. Necessity and chance together don't work. So then there was a third alternative, self-organization. This was by necessity. There was a guy named Dean Kenyon. And Dean Kenyon was a biochemist. And he wrote a book, a chemistry book that was used for many years that taught that the reason, the way this happens is that in each amino acid, there's this kind of like attraction to the other amino acids with which it needs to work with. So it's like putting metal and a magnet. Boom, they're going to attract. So he said that his theory was that all of these amino acids attracted each other in just the right way to make proteins. It was a necessity. They had no choice but to assemble this way because they were built to assemble that way. All by chance, of course. Okay? So it's called biochemical predestination. That was his theory. There are forces of attraction between the individual parts of the protein or the individual parts of DNA molecule that would cause them to arrange themselves in a certain way and produce information we recognize in those key arrangements. In 1985, at an Origins conference, Kenyon spoke about how he had abandoned his own theory. He, the guy who wrote the book, then figured out that it didn't work. He had good, solid answers scientifically that disproved his theory. So he had to abandon the theory. So necessity is not a good explanation either. Self-organization. Michael Polanyi, a friend of Einstein, said, as arrangements of printed page is extraneous to the chemistry of the printed page, so is the base sequence in DNA molecule extraneous to the chemical forces that work in DNA. In other words, here's what he's saying. You get a piece of paper, just like a piece of paper, the paper and the ink don't explain the information. Scientifically, you know what the paper is and you know what the ink is. But the paper and the ink don't explain the information. And that's what he's saying. The amino acids and the parts used to build the protein, they don't explain the information. You need intelligence. You need the message. You need the order. You need somebody to put that into a language, into a code for it to work. And that's what he said. And he was a brilliant scientist. Most scientists are beginning to realize that there's no naturalistic explanation for the origin of information you need to build the first life. What's the best explanation? Maybe we're looking for something that appears designed because it was designed. How's that for an idea? Maybe it looks designed because it was designed. Scientists can't explain the origin of life because they can't explain the origin of information. So how are we sure that there really is no evidence of a purposeful design in nature? All of our scientific observations show that intelligent causes are responsible for information. There isn't a single example in the entire known universe of information coming about from anything other than minds. It's the only source of information. So you have the specified complex information. Chance, we saw it doesn't work. The numbers, the math, blows you out of the water. Impossible. Chance, necessity, doesn't work. Biochemical predestination, doesn't work. Chance and necessity, doesn't work either. What are you left with? Intelligent design is the only option. There had to be an intelligence behind it. So nobody can answer the question of where the information come from in any way that's meaningful, except saying that there is a designer who did it.
There are thousands
Listen
or millions of inter...
Let's get a little bit more volume on that one. This video blow you away. Watch this. When I saw this, it's like the nail on the coffin. Watch this.
There are thousands or millions of interacting computers in every cell that communicate with one another. They read the information. They transfer information from one component to another component. There are many different operating systems involved. There are different programming languages involved with the various components that are within the cell. And all of them have the same components that any other computer would have.
Did you hear that? thousands of computers inside ourselves with different programming languages, different codes, different forms of communication. And these computers have all the parts that a normal computer would have, but obviously at a microscopic level and organic parts, which is incredible. That'll blow your mind. He's, by the way, that guy is an information scientist. He's also a biochemist. So he's not talking baloney here. He's talking with foundation. The guy knows what he's talking about. That's why information science is really blowing this incredible, incredible old theory of evolution out of the water completely. Bill Gates said that human DNA is like a computer program, but far, far more advanced than any software we've ever created. And you think he knows about code and writing software? Just a little bit, right? Okay.
So how accurate was Mr. Gates? Well, in 2010, the noted microbiologist Craig Venter and his team accomplished an incredible feat, surpassing their previous accomplishment of determining the complete sequence of the human genome. They created the first computer-designed, synthetically produced genome, which is the set of application programs for an organism. This artificial DNA had over 1 million letters of genetic code that were then read, processed, and executed by the computer systems in the target cell's nucleus. Thanks to Venter, these biological computers are no longer theoretical. They are experimentally verified.
That's taking the chemistry, the biochemistry, and the computer science and putting it together. Copying the program from DNA into a human program and making it do the same thing the DNA does. It's mind-boggling. This is like Craig Venter. It has just shattered everybody's, blown everybody's mind with the incredible, what he accomplished. By the way, his entire code, which is so successful, was 1 million letters long. 1 million. One section of DNA in the human body is 3.5 billion characters. 3.5 billion letters. Billion with a B. So you're talking about what he has now is Mickey Mouse. It's the little stuff you play with. He's playing now with, you know, building blocks that babies build play with. You know, he hasn't touched making a skyscraper yet. He's just working with the little building blocks. But it proves that the idea that we have computers inside ourselves and a language and a code and communication, it proves it by the experiment that he does. And what did he say? He says life is basically the result of an information process, a software process. Our genetic code is our software, and our cells are dynamically and constantly reading that genetic code. Wow. If there's a software and there's a code, code is information, code is letters. If there's a code and a software and the process, the ability to be able to communicate and translate that information and use it inside the cell, what other option do you have than God to have designed that? There is no other option. It points to God. How could non-living material develop the hardware and the software known to be required by all living organisms? How can an explosion at the Big Bang produce the hardware and the software? What's the natural explanation for producing the hardware and the software? There is none. It's impossible. How did nature develop the arbitrary protocols of communication and coordination among the thousands of computers in each cell? How did that happen? By the way, I mean, you can have a code, but if that code is meaningless to somebody, there's no communication, nothing's going to happen. You need a code, and you need somebody who can read the code and do something with it. If I give you a book on how to be a millionaire, but I give it to you in German, you're not going to be a millionaire because you can't read German. The information is there, but it's useless to you. So the fact that the cell has information and then it is useful and used and read and understood shows you that it's a whole machine working together. It's all a matter of probability. It really does come down to that. What's the probability of a simple cell evolving undirected? Now we're talking about a cell, not a protein, a cell. 250 to 400 proteins, the right proteins, built with all of those gazillion amino acids. What are the odds, okay? The probability of one protein we saw of 150 places was 1 in 10 to the 64th. okay? The probability of one cell, 1 to 10 to the 340 millionth place. In other words, infinite. It's not possible. The number is so huge, it's not possible. The odds, you don't beat those odds. And you're talking about one cell. If I'm not mistaken, we have 5 different types of cells in our body, I think. Or many more different types. Yeah, so for every kind of cell, you would need to beat the odds that way, which is impossible, okay? Watch this video. This is the last video, and we're done. This is going to show you what the odds are of life coming out by chance. When I saw this video, this one also blew me away. This is amazing. It's called the sand. Picking a grain of sand out of how many would be the equivalent of life coming out of nothing. Watch.
Here, we have one tiny grain of sand. It's been estimated that there are 1 million grains of sand in a half a cup. It would take 1 million half cups of sand to fill a swimming pool that's 6 feet deep and 30 feet in diameter. Now, if we took 1 billion of these pools of sand, we could fill Lake Tahoe in Nevada, which is about 22 miles long and 12 miles wide. Think you could find that original grain of sand we started with? We're not done yet. It would take about 1 billion Lake Tahoes to fill the volume of the earth with sand. The probability of grabbing that original grain of sand out of the earth filled with sand is 1 in 10 to the 30th power. It would take 100 million earths to fill one sun with sand, and 1 trillion suns to fill our solar system, 10 trillion solar systems to fill one cubic light year, 100 trillion cubic light years to fill the volume of the Milky Way galaxy, and finally 10 billion Milky Way galaxies to fill the observable universe. Whew. That is a lot of sand. The probability of now randomly picking our original grain of sand from the entire observable universe is 1 in 10 to the 96th power. Still a far cry from our protein being formed at 1 in 10 to the 164th power, and even less chance of life evolving from undirected natural processes at the probability of 1 in 10 to the 340 millionth power. Starting to get the idea? Scientists generally consider anything with a probability of less than 1 part in 10 to the 70th power operationally impossible. And by the way, that calculation doesn't take into consideration the information that's stored in the cell, which directs the cell in all aspects of operation. That estimate is solely the chance of chemicals combining to form something living.
You're more likely to find the grain of sand in the entire known universe filled with sand than you are of getting one living organism by chance. One simple living organism, an amoeba or something. Now, if that doesn't settle it, I'm not sure what will. God's fingerprint is on everything. Those computers, that means, you know, God was in the computer business before Apple and IBM and all of that. Software code, he made the code, man. What we do, we play around with, like, building blocks. He made the code, and he made the systems, and all at such a tiny level. We can't even see it. That's how small it is. It's amazing how it points to God. Now, recently, I've started to try to connect more with the people that I speak with in a lot of different places. You guys are home. But the one new thing I added, if you don't have it already, that's my Twitter account. And it's only that way because Juan Valdez was taken. You know, Dr. Juan Valdez was taken, Jay Valdez was taken, Juan V was taken. Every possibility I could think of was taken. So when I hit that one, it wasn't taken, so we got it. Dr. Juan Valdez. Close enough. Okay. So if you're not following me, go ahead and follow me. If you don't have the app from Reasons for Hope, please get it. That's what it looks like. It's an asterisk with words in it, Reasons for Hope. It has tons of videos, tons of information, articles. It's really good, and it's free. So download the app if you don't have it, and follow me on Facebook. I'm constantly going to be posting, blogging a lot more now through Reasons for Hope and giving you more of this kind of information. If you want the PDF, I can't give you the videos, but I can give you the PDF, which is all the slides with all the information. I can send that to you. Just email me, and I'll send that to you, or FaceTime or message me on Facebook, and I'll send you the PDF of this presentation, so you'll have the information as well. I hope you can see tonight. Can we get the lights now? I hope you can see tonight that we don't have anything to fear. When scientists attack Christians and attack our faith and attack their being a creator, they don't have a leg to stand on. The evidence so clearly points to a designer. That's when Psalm says that the heavens declare the glory of God and the earth his handiwork. That's telling you know what? God has put a signature on everything he's done. And it's undeniable. Saying that there is no God and that everything happened by chance is like saying that the painting painted itself. Or there was an explosion at a paint factory. And there you go. You have a Renoir or you have the Mona Lisa or one of these paintings because the paint factory exploded. It doesn't work that way. There's a painting, there has to be a painter. There's a design, there has to be a designer. There's a computer, there has to be a designer. There's a system so complex, there has to be a designer. Let's stand up tonight.